Hi everyone, it's Stephen Downs here. Welcome back to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. You're looking at my cat, Charlemagne, who has walked himself into a corner along the ledge. This is something that he does quite a bit. Hard to believe, eh? Sometimes that's how I feel about ethics and analytics and the duty of care. You're just following along your ledge. It seems pretty safe and secure, and then you hit the end. You can't back up. You can't go down. Oh, well. So, yes, this is Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. We're in Module 8, and Module 8 covers the topic of ethical practices in learning analytics. And in this section, this is Part 5. Of the series of videos on ethical practices that I'm authoring as part of the four steps in the stairway of ethical practices. I've talked about that a few times now. We started with regulation. Now today we're dealing with ethical practices, just wrapping that up. Then we'll be looking at ethics and culture, and then finally the ethical ethics as viewed, finally toward an approach to ethics as harmony. We'll cash that out when we get there. So, okay, ethical practices, part 5. What we're going to be dealing with here today are basically how to actually activate the ethics in these ethics frameworks. Pointed out the problem with governance frameworks previously. They're based on organizations, agreements, shared presumptions, and not actually motivated by ethics. But there is value in the work that's done, and there is value in the work that's done, particularly with respect to ethics and governance frameworks. And assuming that there is value, you know, there are criticisms, and we need to address those criticisms. But assuming that there is value, we need to talk about how these frameworks are actually activated. How you move from something that's basically raw theory to an actual practice in the field. And maybe I could have started with this, but I decided to end with it. So, 5 basic points. First 2 are related. It's from an HBR article. First of all, talking about what not to do, because they love that. And then what I've called the HBR approach, which I might typify as the approach based on incentives. 2nd and 3rd are related, concepts of knowledge translation and knowledge mobilization. And then one that I think is generally where we trend toward ultimately, something like connective action. And these are sort of like minor steps in our staircase that take the part of the big step of ethical practices. Okay, maybe I'm pushing that analogy too far here. So, what not to do? Per Reid Blackman in 2020, who's writing a practical guide to building ethical AI. So here are the things he says we shouldn't do. First of all, the academic approach. The academic approach is basically, should we do this? Should we do that? Is this right? Is this wrong? And he says, nope. It's just too loosey-goosey. What we should really be asking is, how can we do it without making ourselves vulnerable to ethical risks? Now, I've talked about this risk-based approach already, and how the least risky thing is not necessarily the least ethical thing, and vice versa. Or the least risky thing is not necessarily the most ethical thing, and vice versa. There may be a relation between ethics and risk, but that's a point of view that thinks of ethics as being defined by the role it plays in business outcomes, whether legislatively or in the bottom line. And I think most of us think of ethics as involving more than that. The other thing he says we shouldn't do is what's called the on-the-ground approach. The on-the-ground approach is to actually have people who are working on the software or the AI or data application deal with the ethics themselves as part of the engineering process. And we looked at that under IT governance frameworks. His response, and I kind of alluded to this, engineers, data scientists, and project managers lack the skill, knowledge, and experience to answer ethical questions systematically. So we can't ask the academics who actually study ethics. We can't rely on the engineers, data scientists, and project managers, or product managers, because they just don't have the skill. What about just appealing to the AI principles directly? Well, the difficulty, he says, is in operationalizing these principles. What exactly does it mean to be for fairness? Okay, well, that's a fair point to the extent that it's true. Certainly, there's a lot of dispute about what constitutes fairness, and we've talked about that. And we, I think, have shown pretty much conclusively in this course that there's no single definition of ethics that can apply to everyone in all circumstances and that everybody agrees to. And that's the main weakness with high-level ethics principles. So let's say he has a point here. He's kind of almost at a point here, and which is why I included this discussion in the slides. So what does he suggest instead? Well, this is what I'm calling the HBR approach, although really I should call it the incentives approach. So, again, it's a checklist. So you have to do a bunch of stuff. Identify infrastructure, create the risk framework, change how you think about ethics. Well, this is an interesting one. Change how you think about ethics by taking cues from the successes in healthcare. We're going to look at knowledge translation and knowledge mobilization later on in this video, and that very much takes into account a lot of what's happened in healthcare, which is great. And we looked in the ethical code section. We looked at a whole range of ethical perspectives in healthcare, but at the same time, somebody in Harvard Business School in the United States talking about healthcare as though it's being handled ethically is kind of a problem for me. Because in the United States, as you know, you have to pay on an individual basis for healthcare. There's no national healthcare program, really, to speak of. And so healthcare is hugely expensive and not available to a large percentage of the population. It's better now than it used to be. Now Obamacare exists, which covers a large number of the people who formerly had no access to healthcare. But still, big problems, a not very ethical approach to healthcare, in my opinion. Optimize guidance and tools for product managers, all of which falls under the heading of IT governance, I would say. Build organizational awareness, whatever that means. But the key principle here, formally and informally incentivize employees to play a role in identifying AI ethical risks. Now, probably he means something broader than that. As it's stated now, it's basically an ethical risks bounty, right? You find an ethical risk, you get paid. That's probably not the way it should work. Sometimes incentives are negative incentives, so you would punish employees for not being ethical. Again, probably not what he meant precisely. Overall, I think that the idea is to tie compensation and incentives to ethical performance. not necessarily a bad idea, and certainly it's the free market approach, right? And if it were possible, I'd kind of be in favor of it. That's like me saying, insofar, to the extent that something I like works, I like it. but it's a bit empty otherwise. There's been attempts made to do this in other areas. Climate change is an obvious one where the organization of climate change treaties since Kyoto and forward has been to formally and informally incentivize individuals and companies to produce less carbon, pollute less, contribute less to global warming. And the big objection to that was that it's interference in the free market, even though it is a free market approach to solving climate change. People didn't want to pay for it. And similarly, the sort of objection here that would happen is that people don't want to tie their income and incentives to ethics. If nothing is going to motivate them to be ethical in the first place, they're not going to see the value in tying their compensation to ethics. And, arguably, people really are incentivized by a much wider range of things. I think of tying teacher incentives to the grades produced by students on tests. That's mostly not why teachers got into teaching. It almost, I won't say they don't care what their incentives are. They don't care what their compensation is, because obviously they do. But there are other things in their lives besides compensation, and this shows up every time you see a teacher pushing back against tying incentives to course grades. And the same thing with ethics. And the same thing with any sort of exclusively incentive-based kind of program. It's really hard to pick out and incentivize the exact motivations that a person has to undertake an action. And what you get is some people gaming the system to maximize the incentives, and other people ignoring the incentives and doing what they were going to do anyways. So I think it's kind of, it's kind of an approach based on a certain ideal about the marketplace. But even the marketplace doesn't run according to marketplace principles. And so I don't see why ethics would. And that leads us to knowledge translation, which is the first of the influences that we're going to draw from the field of healthcare. As it says on the side, and I'm quoting from BMC Public Health here, knowledge translation was defined at a consensus meeting of the World Health Organization in 2005 as, quote, the synthesis, exchange, and application of knowledge by relevant stakeholders to accelerate the benefits of global and local innovation in strengthening health systems and advancing people's health. So we could see how this would apply to ethics too, right? We could see how the work that has been done in ethics by the academics, by the engineers, by the people who've developed ethical codes, of which there are many, could be applied by relevant stakeholders to accelerate the ethical benefits of global and local innovation in our case, learning analytics and artificial intelligence. Makes total sense. And we can see the process. And the process is one that has been implemented in healthcare and has produced some beneficial results. So we'll start with KT1. Let's start with S1. I guess that's step one or system one or whatever. Hard to know what these things stand for. Or stakeholder one, that's right. Publishing in plain language and accessible formats. Kind of what I'm trying to do with this MOOC, although I think I failed that probably in the second or third video. Nonetheless, I'd like to bring it back to that. But okay. We have our multi-stakeholder team defining research questions and methods. So here are our questions and methods. And then the research is done with stakeholder engagement. Stakeholders again, right? And then our research findings are placed in synthesis, placing research findings in the context of other knowledge and sociocultural norms. And that's going to feed back into the publications. But more importantly, it feeds into the contextualization in education, we usually say localization of knowledge. In standards, we might say an application profile. And then we apply this knowledge, ethically sound application of knowledge, upholding the priorities of the affected community and ensure knowledge translation process fits within neighborhood. And then we look at the impacts, which will be fed back into our stakeholder team and back into our research process. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So of course there are problems. And in this article in NCBI, there are three assumptions identified that underpin the knowledge translation metaphor. And it's clearly a metaphor. Ooh, my battery may run out soon on my... I'm down to 10%. That's not good. Let's see if I can't, in a hurry, put some battery into the system. Well, that's sort of. And will that help? Or will it still keep doing stuff? Alright, still recording. Okay, still recording, still doing its thing. So hopefully that'll keep working. it's bad. You've done too much audio recording when you've run right out of battery. Okay, so the assumptions also are implicitly here criticisms. So the first assumption. Knowledge is seen as unproblematically separable from the scientists who generate it and the practitioners who may use it. In other words, it's an objectivist approach to knowledge. You have this knowledge that sits there as this thing in itself, not related to the people who create it, not related to the people who use it. Second, knowledge and practice can be cleanly separated both empirically and analytically. You saw the process, right? First you do the research, then you apply it in practice. Nice, clean separation. And then third, practice consists more or less of a series of rational decisions on which scientific research findings can be brought to bear. But arguably, and we've seen this in the ethics, all of our discussions on ethics, all of the codes, all of the theories, all of the practices, etc., underdetermine specific practices in the field. When somebody's actually doing a thing of learning analytics, and they're wondering, is this ethical or not? Everything that the research tells them will not determine an answer. And that's kind of a weakness in the knowledge translation metaphor. You know, no matter how much you translate the knowledge, it's not going to help you in the actual practice. This is interesting to me because this is very much what happened in the philosophy of science generally. And in the philosophy of science, you had this idea that scientific progress was objective and rational, and then could be applied to the world. And through the writings of people like Thomas Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn and W.V. O'Quine and others, we began to see that the distinction between theory and evidence isn't nice and clean. That our theory influences our evidence and our evidence influences our theory. And the same with practice, right? Theory and practice, the division is not nice and clean. Evidence, theory, practice, they're all meshed up in this one big mushy ball. And so you can't just say, we'll take the research and translate it. That, as an aside, because it came up earlier today, is also a pretty good argument against Hattie's effect scales of different educational interventions. So, okay, what do we have beyond translation? Well, we're still in translation. Okay, so lost in translation. Models and processes developed in learning analytics research are increasing in sophistication and predictive power. True. However, the ability to translate analytic findings to practice remains problematic. Also true. In this paper, quoting, first, awareness that a particular tactic or strategy is generally beneficial is often insufficient motivation for a student to adopt it. No surprise there. Just look at statistics on people who smoke cigarettes. They know it'll kill them. They're still smoking cigarettes. Second, the labeling of these practices is itself a challenge. And we looked at labeling and labeling issues when we were looking at the workflow in the analytics and AI workflow. So what we get then following from that is a refinement of the approach called knowledge mobilization. There's a lot to be said for knowledge mobilization. So here's, and I'm drawing from the KMB toolkit here, but also from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada discussion paper on knowledge mobilization. A number of principles or attributes of knowledge mobilization. One, making evidence accessible, understandable, and useful for knowledge users. So you think about that, that's kind of a difference from knowledge translation, because before, the evidence became part of the research and you'd present the research to the practitioner. But now you're presenting the evidence directly to them. See the difference there, right? Secondly, meaningful use of evidence and expertise to align research policy and practice in order to improve outcomes. Now, outcomes, again, is one of these open-ended words that could mean anything depending on who you are, but we'll leave that aside. The idea here is that research policy and practice, and or I could say evidence theory and practice, and be saying the same thing here, in a sense, all need to come together to improve outcomes. Third thing, not just about disseminating information. In other words, not just about sharing or publishing or one-way information flow. It works both ways. We have engagement and user participation and attention to impact, and it includes practice-based evidence from the real world, from the expertise of practitioners. So really what you're doing here is you're breaking down what might be called the researcher-practitioner barrier. And the practitioners become researchers, and in an important sense, the researchers become practitioners. They become two halves of the same enterprise, and they're each engaged in the activities of the others. That is obviously going to result in an approach based on dialogue, collaboration, working together. And so you get the idea here of socialization, externalization, combination, and internalization, all as part of the knowledge mobilization process. It's kind of, and the diagram's trying to get at this in kind of a confusing way, a blending of tacit and explicit knowledge. Now, why some of these arrows are two ways, and so, okay, the tacit to tacit is two ways, and the explicit to explicit is two ways, but the explicit leads into the tacit, and the tacit leads into the explicit. What leads into means, I don't know. Sometimes these diagrams are vague, and it's interesting, right? We go in toward the center, I guess that's the practitioner, and out toward the theorist, or perhaps that's the other way around. It's, again, kind of a two-dimensional description here, but that's okay. We know how we could extend that to multiple dimensions if we needed to. So it's an interesting approach, and this kind of approach does respond to the major objections of knowledge translation. From a knowledge management or knowledge mobilization, I think that's a better, from a knowledge mobilization perspective, and here I'm drawing from a paper from OISE, it involves some what are called things we know about knowledge. I think these things that we know aren't necessarily things that we know, and I think some of them could be considered contentious, but nonetheless, it does give us a framework and a perspective. Knowledge is socially constructed, and its use takes multiple forms. Bodies of consistent evidence are more powerful and effective over time than single studies. Most practitioners have a range of connections to research. Sources of practice and decisions are hard to define with precision. Knowledge is always mediated in some way through various social and political processes. Knowledge by itself is not enough to change practice. The scale of impact matters. The relationship between knowledge and use runs in both directions. And cite Ludwig Wittgenstein here. Personal contact and interaction remains the most powerful vehicle for moving evidence into practice. Interaction, sure. Personal contact, not only a matter of producing more knowledge, but also of improving both the desire and capacity for its use. And I've left out a few points here, but also dedicated effort matters. So this is what might be described as a very postmodernist perspective on knowledge. At the same time, it does take knowledge, properly so-called, maybe not as objective in the way that knowledge translation does, but as objective from the point of view of a particular individual. When something is socially constructed, it is a thing that's out there and not a thing that's in here. And it's a thing that is going to be developed collaboratively through various social and political practices, and is going to have different relations to different things depending on their perspectives. But it's not anything goes, right? It's not subjectivism. It's not a subjective picture of knowledge. And that may be part of the problem with knowledge management when it comes to ethics, because it's really hard to say, for example, ethics is socially constructed. I mean, sure, ethics is socially constructed to a degree, but there isn't a thing, ethics, out there that is socially constructed. It's like we went to construct one thing and constructed a couple thousand things. Similarly, bodies of consistent evidence are more powerful and effective over time than single studies. Probably true. The problem is with ethics, we don't get consistent evidence, etc., right? There's enough differences here between ethics and knowledge that a lot of what's true about knowledge, or at least held to be true from a knowledge mobilization perspective, doesn't hold true in the case of ethics. I would also argue it doesn't hold true from the perspective of knowledge. For example, the relationship between knowledge and use runs in both directions. I would take a very Wittgensteinian approach here and say knowledge is use. We demonstrate that we know something by doing it. For example, now that's a bit sloganish, but I think that we think that there is this artifact out there in the world that constitutes knowledge that we've all built together. And there is this artifact in the world, and it's something, and it's really interesting. But it's not knowledge. It's tools, mechanisms, frameworks, definitions, ontologies, all of these artifacts that we leave behind as we carry ourselves through the world. And these artifacts are useful, and they are used, just like roads and bridges and buildings and cars and whatever else. But all of these things aren't society. And similarly, all of the different artifacts that we use in the context of creating knowledge don't themselves constitute knowledge. It's the difference between talking about all of our ethical behaviors in the world and ethics. Ethics, for me, is how I behave, not how the world behaves. And there's a really big difference between the two. And this is why applying knowledge mobilization can be a bit difficult. And some of the practices here, you can see already how it sort of pushes and stretches what your typical researcher might find comfortable. The need to go beyond traditional publishing is a really good example of this. Now, I'm a living, walking, talking, breathing example of the need to go beyond traditional publishing, because traditional publishing is a terrible outlet for the sort of work that I do. But for a lot of academics, traditional publishing is what they need in order to make their career. So there's a very strong disincentive to mobilize their own knowledge, properly so called. Secondly, researchers need to find an uptake for, quote, strategies that excite them. I've encountered this, right? For example, I spent many years working on personal learning and personal learning environments. It's really hard to find an uptake for that, because personal learning environments do not support the business model of 99% of education technology companies. And in fact, it effectively undermines their business model in significant ways, because it makes education more accessible and cheaper and more in the control of students, and therefore they need less intervention from teachers, universities, and content providers. So, no uptake. But I think that personal learning environments are in many ways more ethical a way to manage learning than, say, learning management systems. Now, I could simply be wrong about this, but the fact that there isn't uptake for the strategy that excites me does not mean that it is not ethically right. And that's why we hit this third challenge, the need to put aside, and I'm quoting, the need to put aside your personal agenda and to challenge your own disciplinary or sectoral approaches to become a part of something bigger. Which is great for the people who want to become a part of something bigger. Not everybody wants to do it. And more particularly, not everyone wants to be a part of that thing that's bigger rather than that thing that's bigger. I mean, I want to be a part of something bigger in the sense that I want to be aligned with all the radicals and the activists and the rights advocates and maybe even the anarchists a little bit, the environmentalists, the gay rights people, etc., etc. That's the bigger I want to be a part of. But mobilizing knowledge, especially the way I do it, doesn't really mesh with that crowd. I love that crowd, but they're not techies, mostly. And so there isn't the techie agenda. And so what do I do? Do I put aside everything that I'm doing, even though I think it kind of works toward that something bigger? No, I forge ahead in my own way, doing my own thing, doing it to the best of my ability, and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. That's not up to me to decide. And that's different. And that's the thing with knowledge mobilization, is that it really tends us toward these group-based, collaborative-based projects where you subsume your own interests underneath a larger, broader, some other kind of interest. It might be a corporate interest, it might be a cultural interest, a social interest, whatever. And these really are basically defined by these four sectors here: community, government, private sector, or academic institutions. If you can't find an interest under any of those, you can't do knowledge mobilization. And to me, I say so much the worse for knowledge mobilization. So not surprisingly, instead of, collective action, which is essentially what knowledge mobilization is, I favor something like connective action. And now I don't want to misinterpret this article here, and let's be clear that this article isn't saying exactly what I'm saying. But I'm drawing from the article to make the point. So, drawing from the article, from Priyanka Singh, it's the idea that forms of activism that focus on quiet acts of caring rather than an amplification of a message or a platform. So, connective action isn't based on mass, it's based on connection. Now, in the particular discussion here, it talks about using hashtags as a form of connective action. But I don't think that's quite it. I don't think hashtag activism is the same as connective action. So I'll leave that aside. Now, let's not bring that part of it into the discussion. But there is the distinction between working as a person in a network, touching other people in a caring kind of quiet way, as opposed to getting up on a podium and mobilizing people into action. Saidiya Hartman says, it's a movement driven not by uplift or the struggle for recognition or citizenship, but by the vision of a world that would guarantee to every human being free access to earth and full enjoyment of the necessities of life according to individual desires, tastes, and inclination. That's kind of what I'm after with connective action. So the idea of personalizing contentious politics and the personalization of contentious politics was written about by Bennett and Segerbert a few years ago now. It's not that long ago. But the key ideas here are of a platform inclination as an alternative to standing up to or against something. And I interpret that as, building rather than agitating, being the person who actually creates the connections, does the thing that instantiates the value rather than trying to convince someone else to instantiate the value. It's the idea of producing hope rather than looking for hope in the sky. It's the distinction between a performance of care, you know, a performative act, versus doing the work of care, actually doing the work. And it's the idea of communicative labor at the point of organizing rather than the more visible and the more mass-based forms of resistance. So there's a lot there that speaks to me. And where we're going to go with this in general, I'm going to be talking about culture next, but it's not culture in the sense of mass. It's not culture in the sense of everybody speaking French, or everybody going to church on Sunday, or everybody enjoying the hockey game, or anything like that. It's closer, I think, to culture in terms of the way I defined community earlier, community as consensus, of ways of coming together to decide on how we agree on what's true in society. And in the case of ethics, it would be how we get together to decide on what's right. And not just generically, you know, that would apply to everyone, but what's right here, now, in this context. When I'm performing my individual act of care, how do I decide what is right? What is the mechanism for that? And I think that that's a different way of seeing the role of all the ethical work that gets done and what actually constitutes ethics in practice in real life. It's not really about the research and the organization and the publication of papers and the running of surveys and all of that. It's about the cumulative weight of individual acts of care in a society, which defines what our ethics are. And the first level of talking about that will be to talk about that as a cultural phenomenon. And then later on, we'll talk about what that means from the perspective of ethics itself. So that's where I'll leave this discussion. A little bit hanging, but that's probably where we should be, because really what we're concluding at the end of this section is that ethical practices don't define ethics. It's like regulation maybe tells us what we shouldn't do. Ethical practices give us a framework for implementing what we should do and shouldn't do, but we need this other thing in order to inform the practices, the research, the product, the implementation of analytics and artificial intelligence. So that's it for ethical practices. I'll see you again for the culture segment of the module. I'm Stephen Downs. Thanks for hanging in there with me. We're almost through this.